Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's July 10th, 2016, and welcome to episode 130 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
ERCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and source code. I am joined here by several retro computing enthusiasts. First in Sweden, we have Jack Nutting. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, Paul. Can't complain.
Oh, I'm sure you can.
Yeah, I won't though.
Just try a little harder. Up in Canada, we have Carrington Vanston. How are you?
I'm second in Sweden. He's first in Sweden. I'm nipping at his heels, though. Soon, I too will be first in Sweden. Then we will battle Highlander style.
Going into extra time. And over in Portland, we have Earl Evans. How are you, Earl?
I'm fan-stinking-tastic. And I also hear I'm popular in Sweden, although I'm modest, so I won't talk about that.
All for the best, I'm sure.
Yes.
And I am, I guess I didn't say I am Paul Hegstrom in Boston. And
none of us said that we are Paul Hegstrom in Boston.
We are here to retrocompute your world.
Oh, goodness, is that our new slogan?
So it's up to me today to come up with the host's topic, since I am the host. And the topic I came up with is one of the things that we'll be talking about is some source code that has become available. And I was thinking, as more original source code has become available that people have found or released into the public. So, as I say, we'll talk about a couple. Others that have come in the recent past are Apple II, DOS, Xerox, Alto, Microsoft Basic, CPM, and then among games and things, there's Prince of Persia and Glider and Wander and Star Raiders, and there's many more things that have been just becoming available for us to look at in their original form. And it made me wonder what kinds of things we hope to learn, why is this good? It is good. It must be good. But why is it good? What are we hoping for as we get these bits of source code? And I was just curious to see what people thought of that. I have a few ideas on why this is good and what we can hope to gain, or maybe not. Maybe we'll just discover that actually there's no point. But I think that isn't where we're going. So what do you guys think, Earl? What thoughts do you have on this?
Well, if we can reverse engineer the technique that they use to create the code, then maybe we'll get a little bit of continuity about the history of programming and how it's either improved or changed or whatever you want to call it throughout the years. Certainly it was like walking 5 miles uphill in the snow both ways when you were cranking out 6502 assembly by hand or some of these other modest systems. So maybe in that sense, it's hard to compare what it would be like to write that code to the stuff we do now. But I am curious about the state of the art, and I mean that quite literally in this case. Like, what was the artisan method of writing code back then? What would really be illuminating would be if you could see several versions of a program as it made its way to completion. Like, was it kind of sculpted? Or did people use a bunch of structure like, we tend to do now with this successive approximations? That's the kind of thing that I would like to see.
Yeah, it's because it does seem like people were sort of just trying to figure it out at that point. There wasn't much to go on, and a lot of people sort of on their own figuring things out. But part of what I was wondering about was whether there's any applicability into the future. I mean, like, once we know how somebody figured out, you know, how to do a sort in their basement by themselves, you know, is that useful going forward, or is it just interesting? I guess one of the things I was thinking is it's kind of like art in a way. You know, you're sort of appreciating the thought process, even if it's not something you're going to use.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we'll discover any Tesla or Da Vinci level miracles of intelligence or anything in there. And because software development's so qualitatively different these days than it used to be, I'm not sure that a lot would be applicable to modern day programming, but certainly historically, I think it's good to take a look at these and see how they stack up against the code that we write today.
Mm-hmm. Carrington, what thoughts have you on these?
Useless. I'm going to be the contrarian again. I think it's super interesting from an archaeological standpoint, and I think it can be very interesting in particular, as Earl was talking about, looking at the stages of development in kinds of programming, approaches to problems, approaches to solutions, that sort of thing, to see how things propagate, who is influenced by what. One of the big differences, of course, between software and, say, a novel, the final product of software like stops functioning in when you get far enough away from those computers. We can only use it now in emulators, and even those can eventually, I guess, go away. So having code is another method of preserving something that might not be executable in the future. And it's like having the recipe for popular food from years ago. But just because we have medieval recipes doesn't mean they're necessarily going to influence the way we cook or what we want to eat nowadays. I love it when this software comes up. I poured through the Prince of Persia software. It was just so interesting to look at that code. In particular, comments, well-commented code is a joy to read. But I don't know if I necessarily learn anything from it, because often when I'm reading through somebody else's code, I can't understand it. When I read through my own code from, say, 10 years ago, I can't understand what I was doing. I mean, that's just the nature of software. It just becomes nonsense after a while. So I don't know how useful it is in a utilitarian standpoint, but I do think it's of incredible historical and archaeological interest, and in particular, I think of incredible cultural interest. I'm a huge fan of Lane Nooney, who is a cultural historian and like an historian of video games computing. She's the one who's working on that Sierra Online novel that I'm anxiously awaiting. She and the things that she writes have opened my eyes to the way bits of technology and bits of computer culture had effects on other culture, other parts of society, and how society had effect on computer culture in ways that I didn't really realize how interactive they would be, and like where a computer would be in your house and those sorts of things. So I think looking at software with that kind of mindset, like what was affecting the early writers of games or word processors, and what were the cultural influences, what were the things they were doing because of time constraints, because like how did they solve things not the way they wanted to, but the way they had to because of their boss, because of some implementation of DRM that they needed to shoehorn in, or because of a branding thing or whatever. That kind of stuff might be unlocked through a look at the code in a way that it would be obscured if you only look at the final product. So I think there's opportunities for research and knowledge that get unlocked by these. So those are useful in the future, but I don't know how much as a software developer I would learn from those versus just, you know, training and learning stuff on the job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so Jack, what do you think? Will you use any parts of the Apollo guidance computer in iOS apps?
Unlikely. Although I tend to agree with all of what Carrington said, that I think it's terribly interesting from like an archaeological standpoint and a historical standpoint, and it makes me think about, you know, once we have source code to things like Apple II DOS and CPM and things of that era, I think about, you know, way back when Newton and Leibniz both invented calculus about the same time.
suspiciously.
You know, kind of each in their own little vacuum, right? It was something. It was some sort of something that was in the air, right? Like this is the point in time where this kind of thing, you know, sort of comes into existence, even though different people are doing it in different ways, and like there's probably very little overlap or zero overlap in terms of people who worked on CPM and people who worked on Apple II DOS, right? But they had to solve some of the same kinds of problems on hardware with similar constraints. And I think it'd be very interesting to see, you know, how different tracks of thought that may have led to stuff that, you know, in some cases is probably very similar, in some cases very different. And I think there's a lot of academically useful stuff here, but in terms of what's actually practically useful, I mean, sure, if you want to make an Apple II game today or an Atari 8-bit game today, some of the source code that has come out in the past couple of years is going to be very helpful in learning how to do things the way that they were done, you know, by the people who were best at it 30, 40 years ago. But that's a very small number of people who actually want to do that. Of course, we are among those kind of sort of people, so who knows?
Yeah, I guess I was also thinking, so one of the other things that people have used these for is to fix bugs, you know, like, or,
right.
You know, try to make the explosions in Star Raiders go less laggy or whatever.
Right.
And that's, you know, that is something that's sort of a fun project in a way. Like, it's not clear that that's academically or culturally useful, but it certainly is like a fun hobby thing.
Right.
So
something Jack said, I'm going to throw it back to him that I agree now with him. So Jack and I, you and I, same wavelength. It's excellent. It never occurred to me until you said it, but of course, back then there was real competition between different platforms. And so somebody developing a game for the Apple II versus somebody developing a game for, say, C64, especially at different software houses, would encounter and have to solve the same problems, and they wouldn't be able to necessarily collaborate or look at how each other solved it. So they would have to independently and under a decent time and market constraint solve a problem to get their game published. So it would be very interesting to look at the development of certain things, like, hey, this is now a thing that appears in gaming, 3D stuff appears or you know, maze finding or whatever, and how did different people at different software developers independently solve that and kind of compare and contrast their approaches to the solutions and see at what point did one of those solutions win out and propagate as the knowledge disseminates and propagate to everybody else. Now, suddenly everyone's solving it the Atari way or something like that would have happened. But you know what I mean? Just as an example.
You might be able to use that to kind of like follow programmers around from company to company.
Well, yeah. That's it. And look for that kind of fingerprint or just see like who suddenly there was massive plagiarism that we can now expose or who knows what.
Yeah, very cool. I mean, another thing that kind of like made me think about this was that, you know, I haven't really looked. I kind of opened up some of these source code files and I did look a little bit through them. In fact, as from what I recall, I think in the Prince of Persia source, there was evidence of maybe I even talked about this back at the time, but evidence of like a little kind of an Easter egg that you could, you know, you could trigger and it would make your disk drive sound like a motorcycle based on like where you moved the joystick. But, you know, I'd never have come across that myself. So, but yes, I guess the sidetracked on that. What I was thinking was that I wonder if I really am going to sit down and really figure this out or if it's just kind of neat to know that I could. But probably not all of them. I don't know. It's an interesting topic to think about. If anyone does, you know, discover neat new things in these released source code repositories that we've gotten access to, let us know. We would be interested to hear about that. I think I'll close the topic off unless anyone else had something else they wanted to say. And the silence says no. Okay, so we have a couple of listener feedback things we can talk about. So Oscar wrote in to alert us to the upcoming Vintage Computer Festival Zurich, November 19th to 20th. So there's some time left. There's details at the website that will be in the show notes, but it's www.vcfe.ch. Quite a lot of confirmed exhibits already planned, but Oscar says that there's plenty of space for more. So if you have one that you'd like to present, there's information on how to get a hold of them there. Looks quite interesting. I can pretty much guarantee I will not personally be able to attend, but people who are close should check it out. Jack, you're sort of close.
I'm sort of close. It looks like fun. Yeah. I'm not ruling it out. I would love to go.
But anyway, thanks Oscar for alerting us, and we hope that it's well attended and looks really fun. So maybe Jack, you can talk about this one. Wade replied and correcting us on a couple of notes about the Atari portfolio.
Yes, Wade Ripkowski let us know some of my so-called facts about the Atari portfolio were just conjecture on my part, based on my faulty memory. So it came out in June of 1989, I think we're saying. It doesn't run MS-DOS, it runs something called DIP-DOS. I don't know what that is, but DIP-DOS 2.11, which is built into the ROM, it's supposed to be 99% compatible with MS-DOS, and it did not use PCMCAA, but a similar style of card but incompatible called the B card. And the screen was 40 by 80, and there's a whole special episode of Inverse ATASCII on that. We'll link to that episode of that fine podcast as well.
Also, it's 40 by 8.
But so what did I say?
40 by 80.
Yeah, not 40 by 80.
However, I've often wondered, listening to other podcasts, if maybe a good strategy for getting feedback is to say erroneous things. There are particular podcasts that I listen to with clenched fists. But
yeah. Also, 99% compatible just means has bugs.
Yes, like, different bugs.
Okay, sure. Yeah, it's 99% compatible.
Let's see, and I guess the last bit of feedback I'll mention here is that Bruno wrote to alert/remind us about the Easy to Learn, Hard to Master, The Fate of Atari documentary Kickstarter. I don't recall if we talked about that before. I think we might not have, but these are the people, 8-bit generation, who made Growing the 8-bit Generation, The Commodore Wars, which already came out. I think that was a few months ago. And this is, from what I remember about this, I didn't read through the Kickstarter actually super carefully, but I think this is basically, they did a whole lot of interviews for a larger project, and they kind of released the Commodore stuff as the movie that they already put out. And so now they're turning to the Atari stuff, but it's sort of drawing on the same interviews that they already had done. So they're actually pretty close. It ends in 6 days as we record, and it's only about $1,000 away from about a $23,000 goal. So if you haven't taken a look at that, take a look at it if you feel like supporting it. It's not far to go, but it's not there yet. So I'm quite looking forward to seeing the Commodore one. I have not yet. I don't think I would have had a chance. Oh, no, actually, I think I missed a chance about a month ago. It was at the app party, but anyway, it's, as far as I can tell, it's only going to sort of individual venues at the moment, and it will be distributed soon, the Commodore one, and this is for the Atari one. For some reason, I feel like I hadn't come across the Atari Kickstarter before. I don't know how that could be, but
yeah, I don't think I had either. I'm less interested in the Commodore one. Gasp of shock from everybody. But this one catches my eye, and I'm trying to get off Kickstarter because I'm an immediate gratification kind of guy. I want to pay my money and get the thing. I don't want to pay my money and then someday in the future I get the thing. It's just, I don't like the whole process of that. But I want this to succeed, and I think I would like to look at this, so I will probably be backing it. This looks really good.
Yep, looks pretty cool.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so we'll leave the feedback recitation at that. We did get a couple of other people writing in with a couple of links that got scattered through our items of interest and news, to which section we turn now.
Actually, I'll try to make a lot of mistakes during the rest of the show so we get people to write in.
Perfect. Perfect.
So anything I say that's incorrect going forward, I'm doing that on purpose.
As are we all.
I can start. So the Apple II was invented by a guy named Leo Zeminski. It used a 6809 processor.
All true.
And it came with 2 megabytes of bubble RAM.
But it was simultaneously invented by Leibniz, like independently. It's remarkable. They both came up with it at once.
At the same time, yeah, independently, yeah.
And somehow both had this weird reverse graphics mode thing.
Yep.
Every third line, because it's easier to divide by 3, it turns out.
Apparently, and to have most of a chunk of memory kind of go to the screen, but not in any particular order, and little bits of it that simply just won't. The screen holes suck.
Okay, yes. So yep. with that out of the way, Carrington, you can talk immediately about the thing we were just talking about in the host topic.
Yeah, indeed. So this is a really nice article. The code that took America to the moon was just published on GitHub. And if that phrase doesn't get you heading over, then you are foolish and should not listen to our podcast. So really, really exciting. So it's exactly what it says. So what we have here is the code that supposedly took America, wink, wink, to the moon, wink, wink. The neat thing is you can read in the comments about how, why should we even work on this? We're not really going. It's all just like, so that's fun. And speaking of the comments, so what's exciting about this is, of course, there's the fact that the software is there and you can look at it. And that's really neat and exciting. But what's more exciting is, of course, since it's on GitHub, people are now looking through it and trying to fix errors and talk about stuff. And the comments on it are also hilarious, like how this was fixed in Apollo 14. It's just like, oh, it's so good. But there's jokes and interesting things in the comments to the software. During our opening topic, I talked about how well-commented software is a joy. And well-commented software isn't software where the comments say what is happening. Like when you say, you know, this is adding 1 to X, that doesn't help you. It's why it's happening is the interesting thing for a comment. But here there are things like, please crank the silly thing around. Or one where it's like, there's somebody commenting about a bunch of things that are temporary. I hope. But nope, they turned out to be permanent. It's just seeing things like that is just great. So it's the comments that make it worth looking at. But all of it's worth looking at. And this is an example of something that I think is exciting and important historical code. And so I'm very happy that it exists, and it exists in a public place where it can be backed up and grabbed by people like Jason Scott and never be taken away from us again. So really happy about this. I think it's very exciting. Lots of funny things. And Paul, you added in some other links as well to talk about that I think are related to this, right?
Oh, yeah. I got kind of enthusiastic about this and looked at there are a couple of other places that this was posted. So Hackaday had a frame article around a video of a guy named Don Iles I think Don Iles is the person who actually is the reason that we have this code, because he may have the last, you know, paper green bar, you know, copy of this thing. And it's huge. So there's a video of him in, I think, the MIT faculty club with this. I mean, it's seriously, it's got to be like 8 inches thick or something like that. might even be bigger, of like wide green bar paper. And he's kind of flipping through it and kind of pointing out like what's in there. And obviously he's not really walking through all of it, but he's kind of just describing it in a way. And it's neat. It's neat to see this. And so from what I understand, this is where the, transcribing that was how the GitHub repository came to be. So that's neat to look at. The sound's a little iffy, but it's still pretty cool. And then there is a sort of contemporary video, like from the time. I'm trying to find the tab I opened it in, but anyway, it's called Computer for Apollo, and it was it might have been an MIT produced video, but it was the MIT science reporter who talks on a number of these videos of the time about computers and things going on at MIT. But it's pretty interesting to look at, and it's kind of just astounding, you know, how involved the making of this thing was. They go through how the memory was programmed by threading wires through these little things, and it's amazing. I don't know if any of you have seen it, but go watch it if you haven't.
The memory thing in particular, this threaded memory, I think they call it, is crazy, and I had no idea about this. And I'm like, what is this? Like, so that's super awesome and interesting, and was something I did not know about.
Unbelievable that this thing worked at all.
it's crazy. Like, you look back at it now, and the idea that today, if somebody said, let's send some people to the moon, and I want to use this tech to do it, we just lock them up and go, you're a crazy person. It's just like, you're just going to murder some astronauts. So, I mean, that's, you know, what they had, but it's bonkers that this was successful. I'd also like to make a comment on the Hackaday one. In the same way that I think most of us share a love for the industrial design of old computers from the 80s, like when we were kids, and older things and big iron and all that. And I think it's probably also the case that all of us and everyone listening, there's something just gorgeous about green bar paper. Like, it's just like seeing something. That's how all things, all code should be reviewed on green bar. It's just, it's the way it's supposed to be. I love it so much.
I want to get some, but it's so darn pricey. I've got a wide carriage printing terminal, you know, one of the daisy wheel things.
Mm.
And boy, those things sound like a jackhammer when you
fire them up. Daisy wheels.
But, you know, I want to do some printouts on Greenbar, but they don't give that stuff away.
Plus, daisy wheels are so hard to connect to anything modern. I have struggled like crazy to get my daisy wheel to work with my modern Mac under OS 10, and they do not want to talk with each other. It is just so frustrating. I love daisy wheels. I know they're slow. I know they're loud, but I like them even more than dot matrix ones, and I really, really want to be using one, but it is a struggle. I've been trying for, it's got to be 6 months now to get this thing working, and I have failed miserably so far.
The other thing I wanted to mention, there's a book that was discussed in the press having to do with this Apollo code. The book is called Digital Apollo, and it's from MIT Press. I haven't read it yet. I have it on a waiting list at my local library system. But when I get it and read through it, I'll let you guys know. One of the things that it talks about is the fly-by-wire versus the astronaut taking the stick and actually doing the manual flight. And apparently on the six Apollo flights, where they were talking about this computer, that happened, that the astronaut went, I'll fly this thing. Not going to have a computer flying me for whatever reason. So
yeah, and I think they were designed to have to be fly-by-wire because part of it, like during the descent and stuff, you're knocked around so much, there's a good chance you'll be unconscious during it. So the computer
there is just
to
too
fly
much. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that came up in the video too, that it, you know, it's just too complicated for any human to do.
And of course, astronauts would be like, what? Come on, I'm an astronaut. Give me the stick. I'll put it in manually.
Yeah.
Which is both the good and very bad thing about people who have the mindset of astronauts.
Right. Ex test pilots or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's actually another.
All test pilots are eventually ex test pilots. That is the nature of that job.
I suppose that is a sad truth, but. Yeah, oh, there's another link actually in the Hackaday article to a kind of a separate thing that the guy was walking through the code, Don Isles. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I've now said it several times, but he had some
people will write in.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, I hope you're pronouncing it wrong. I hope it's not even pronounced Don. Yeah.
I think it's Don Johnson, actually, the guy from Miami Vice.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. Unless it was Rickles.
Of the many Dons you go with, you're gonna pick Rickles. Excellent.
He was great in Miami Vice.
It's true. But, however, there was a little bit of a thing that he did with Apollo 14 as well. He did a kind of like a very time-constrained, last-second code fix on Apollo 14 that I think was basically to override abort button or something, you know, that it would have automatically aborted because the button was misreading or something, as if they were pressing it. And so he had to quickly patch the code, you know, somehow to make that not happen. So there's a heroic thing as well with Apollo 14. So anyway, very interesting stuff. You could spend a day reading on this easily. So
I did.
Excellent. But okay, let us move on to Commodore. Earl, you have something about, well, why don't you tell us?
Well, I do. Commodore, the Comvex show that's in Vegas every year, is actually up to their 12th instance. So good on them. And again, this year, there's going to be one of the alumni from Commodore there. Commodore engineer Bill Seiler, who worked on, among other things, the VIC-20, will be there on both days. It's coming up on Saturday, July 30th, Sunday, July 31st. And again, like they always say at Comvex, it's Vegas, baby. You know, what you Commodore in Vegas stays in Vegas. So we'll have a link to the notice about Bill Seiler and also just a general link for the Comvex show in the show notes.
So if he's behind the VIC-20, is he there to give a talk or just apologize?
Oh, yeah. It's a wonder computer of the 80s, and I've got a William Shatner video to prove it.
Wasn't it? It was something like the friendly computer or something, wasn't it? There was some. It had some tagline like that.
Very friendly. Because it only had 5K of RAM. It didn't have enough RAM to have an attitude.
Right. Yeah, I sort of feel like maybe my elderly age here is just like shrunk time so much, but I feel like Comvex just happened. Was there another Commodore convention just recently? Or
There are two or three Commodore shows throughout the year, but the Comvex show usually happens in the summer in Vegas.
Okay. Well, cool. Jack. Oh, yes. You have some...
I have some things. It's an article from PCMag.com. It's one of these things that, like, I found this on Facebook, and it's a terrible thing where you have to sort of page through to see the thing. But it's cool. So the idea is, it's 7 classic home PC follow-ups that were never released.
Sounds like such clickbait. You won't believe number 5!
Yeah, I know. It's terrible. So it's in an obnoxious format, but it's kind of worth looking at. There are some of the things I knew about. The Commodore 65, we've talked about before. The Atari 1450 XLD, I knew about, and I know we've talked about before. But some of these things I'd never heard of. Like, there was the... Well, we have talked about the Atari Falcon. There was also the Atari Microbox Falcon, which was in a smaller sort of separate box instead of the sort of ST case. The Tandy Color Computer 4, I'd never heard of such a thing. The Mattel Aquarius 2. Huh?
Yeah.
Crazy stuff. And the Apple IIgs Mark Twain. It was scheduled to maybe come out in 1991 and did not. So
the Coco 4 looked cool. I want somebody to make that now. Can we call up Tandy?
See what
that thing
up
looked
to.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So worth checking out. I'd never seen any of these things. Or I'd seen only 2 of them. So
I like the Coco 4 looks amazing. I'd never heard of that before at all. Not even a hint of it being a thing that was considered. So that was exciting. And I agree that it looks amazing because it's got the neat keyboard from the Coco 3 basically, but then stuff sitting on top of it. Yes. it grew a brain. And I like the Coco 3. I had an original Coco as a kid and I quite liked it, although super underpowered. So a Coco 3 would be very sweet to have. That's on my if I had more space and more time for things list, I would definitely want a Coco 3 included. Or this super awesome Coco 4, but the 3 would be great.
Yeah, and it seems like a theme on a couple of them is it's sort of like the computer you know plus like an attached box to make it look like an Apple III.
Right.
Basically, because that was going to hit the world by storm.
Yeah, I discovered the existence of the Mattel Aquarius 2 maybe only like a couple months ago or something. It showed up as there was like a, I don't know, like a brochure or something for it. Oh no, it was an Aquarius magazine, an issue of which was about the forthcoming Aquarius 2. I failed to win the bids on that one.
The first computer in this, the TI-99/8, which was the going to be follow-up to the /4A, although technically if you're dividing by 8, this is a lower number. I don't know if they realize that or not, but whatever. That one, I remember, there was a few years ago, one of those popped up on eBay and went for like $3,000 or $4,000 or something. Mm. So it was created enough to be a thing that was real. It just never got released.
Right.
Yeah. I think, I can't remember if I've actually seen the Mark Twain before, but I think there are like, there may be like 2 of them total.
I think Tony has one. Didn't he bring it to Kansas Fest one year? I think maybe he's got one of everything. He's got to have one of those.
He definitely has one, and I'm sure he has brought it. I just can't remember if I was there at the one at one of the ones right. where he did. But
but hey, folks, if you're listening, that's the kind of thing you can see if you come to Kansas Fest, which is happening so soon, and I'm crazy excited.
Yeah, I typed on an actual Apple One at Kansas Fest.
I also typed on an actual Apple One at Kansas Fest. That's the kind of thing you get to do at Kansas Fest.
All right. Okay, so moving on. I have the next one, and it is the museum, what is it? The Museum of Art and Digital Entertainment has posted the source code to LucasArts Habitat, which is a very early massively multiplayer online game from that I think was basically hosted on Quantum Link. So it's basically a Commodore 64 game, I believe. And so the source code has become available and is now on GitHub also. So when you're done looking at the Apollo guidance computer, you can look at this. And it's pretty cool. We've already sort of covered the kind of the significance of getting the source code, I guess, in the topic. But it's not something I experienced, not having Quantum Link which Quantum Link is the ancestor to AOL, I believe. But this is one of those things that doesn't work anymore. You know, like it disappeared once the infrastructure disappeared, and so and I don't think even yet it quite works. The source code is there, but some of the backing technologies are not acquired yet. So I think AOL still has some of this stuff in there under their control, but you can at least sort of look at the stuff, and I think probably the graphic the resources are there and stuff. So has anyone, I guess Earl, you'd be the one who would be most likely to have come across this in your past. Did you ever play this game? Do you know it?
I didn't. I didn't have Quantum Link back in the day. And I guess they didn't do a all that good a job of marketing to Commodore folks, because I didn't even know it existed back in the day, although a lot of the Commodore people really loved it. And you guys all probably saw when Quantum Link Reloaded had come out, that effort to restore Quantum Link and make it work with the original discs. People were jumping on that and very excited. One of the things that they mentioned was they sure wish that Habitat also, or its, I think its successor, Club Carib, could be restored as well, because they had such a great time on that massive multiplayer system in the past. I guess, you know, relationships were formed, people met each other. I think some people even got married, you know, through that thing. It was just, it was a big deal for the Quantum Link folks back in the day. And yeah, I wish it worked. It sounded like from that article that there's still some bits missing. And I'd never heard of that. What are the Stratus Technologies or something like that? That online transaction processing system that the back end ran on. Had you guys ever encountered that name before?
Nope.
No, I don't think so. It sounds like a name I might have heard of, except that I don't think so.
I mean, it sounds kind of like the Hewlett-Packard Nonstop type of technology or something like that. It was highly redundant, very fault-tolerant online transaction stuff for a lot of people to plug into. I just never encountered it.
Well, and I think they did make some reference to, yeah, so much of this is in PL1, you know, so a language I know nothing about except I think I know how to pronounce it. So,
right in to tell us he got it wrong.
Yes. And these things are so tricky because, like with Quantum Link, but also probably even more so in this case, if you were to get it working, what you'd wind up with is a ghost town. You know, you'd have like two people wandering around in like opposite ends of the world, and that's it.
That actually did kind of happen with Quantum Link Reloaded. Once they had the server online, there was a massive influx of people who just wanted to get on, try it out, relive some of their memories, but it got really quiet after a fairly short amount of time.
Yeah. The Quantum Link Reloaded team, by the way, was helped out with this as well. They were mentioned in this article. It's interesting, again, to get the source code, and you know, it's interesting for me to even know about this. This apparently Habitat only lived for a couple of years. It was in 1986 to 88. So I guess it's not that strange then, Earl, that you didn't hear of it. But anyway, and if you, particularly if you do remember Habitat, go take a look at this, or if you remember Quantum Link, or just want to know what kinds of things people are doing with online communities and trying to bring them back. Okay, we can move on. Carrington, you have the next one on writing software and histories and so forth.
Exactly. This is basically the mirror image to the first thing I talked about, and again, it's amazing how many of the things we're talking about all seem to relate to each other. So this is how to write a history of writing software, which is an oddly phrased title for this article, which appeared in The Atlantic, and it's about an upcoming book. But it's a fascinating topic, and I love this kind of cultural archaeology when it comes to technology. So this is an article about an investigation into the idea of doing a history of changes to the act of writing, changes to being a novelist, basically, but also any sort of writer, poets and short stories and journalists and all that, and how that profession and that hobby were affected and had to have been affected by the switch in technology away from typewriters to word processors. And all the little things that bubble out, everything from, for instance, being able to look at Joyce's The Wasteland and all the drafts of that. Like we just talked about how it'd be interesting if you could have various versions of software so you could see how things get changed, if you can look at source code over time. And it had been the case often with early works, early novels, you could find drafts because they were typed out on typewriter, and they were edited by hand and then usually just not thrown away. And so that original draft manuscript might still be around and an academic could look at differences. Whereas with modern software, it's all ephemeral and it's just writing and you're moving things around and cutting and pasting. And does anybody hang on to the drafts and things? So it talks about the novelist Max Berry, a guy that I actually quite like, and how he writes and every draft of every version is made available and saved. But not all authors do that. So that's one thing that gets affected. But also, you can write, novelists can start writing in many different places with the advent of portable computers and luggable computers and eventually laptop computers and tablets and such versus a big 25 or 35 pound manual typewriter that would be anchored to a desk. And that's where you do your writing and your revising might be on paper, but your typing was in a certain place. And then suddenly Isaac Asimov gets a word processor or a computer and says, well, I should stick it in the back of the bedroom. And instead his wife says, no, it should go in the living room. And that changes the place of writing, and which itself will change the mood. Maybe it changes how often you revise something, and just so many things bubble out from that. So it's a very fascinating, very intricate topic, and I find it really interesting. This is a neat article that goes off in a lot of different directions to sort of get you thinking about the subject. And then there's a novel coming shortly about it. A nonfiction book coming shortly about it. It brings us back to Lane Nooney again, a name that I frequently will drop because she just writes such interesting things. And she looked at the effect of the personal computer on and where it was placed in the household and how that affects things. And so those sorts of ideas are brought up again. So the whole topic is really interesting. And I think it's just as interesting from a written word standpoint as it is from a software development standpoint. All the same sort of things bubble up, but we have such a long history of writing, you know, thousands of years, and so it's something that changed rather than just got developed differently like it did with software. So I find it very fascinating. This is a really interesting article. I strongly recommend if any of these topics resonate with you that you should go read this. It's really a good read.
Yeah, no, I definitely will have to read this. And I was also struck that, you know, I completely misread the title. I thought it was about writing software, and it's about writing software.
Exactly. And so it's a history of word processing, basically, but not limited to the idea of a word processor. But it should have been how to write a history of word processing would have made people understand what this is about. Because it's just like, it sounds like it's about our first topic, but no, it's about the software of writing and not just software, about changes to the hardware, the nature of the physical act of writing and how that got computerized and how that inevitably affects the both the hobby and the profession of writing in lots of different ways. So really, really interesting. Lots of things that I hadn't thought of are in this article. So I'm really going to be looking forward to the book itself.
So is the book you're talking about the track changes?
Maybe it's going to be by this guy, Matthew Kirschenbaum. I thought it wasn't out yet. Is it actually out?
It says publication date May 2nd, so I think it may actually be out. So.
Oh, you know what? Yes, it is. Okay, fantastic. So during the rest of this, I will now be ordering it. We can listen along while I do it. I've clicked buy here.
Okay.
Shall I walk us through the process? Oh, look, PayPal is an option. Let's choose that. Ships only to the United States. Screw you all. Man, see?
All right. Well, while you're finding your U.S. address to ship it to.
I do have one of those. I do have a remailer I could use, but I might just steal his book instead. Not kidding.
Of course. Jack, this sounds familiar. You have a pocket chip.
Yeah. So we talked some time ago, quite a while ago, I think, about this thing called Chip, which was being pitched as the world's first $9 computer, which is now shipping, and it's, you know, as in terms of being the world's first $9 computer, they've pretty much been leapfrogged since then by the latest Raspberry, like the Pi Zero and that sort of thing. But what they've done further, though, is they have developed this into a concept of this little handheld computer called the Pocket Chip, which is tiny thing, you know, think of sort of a Game Boy format, little screen, full QWERTY keyboard plus other keys. And the beauty of this is that it has built in this thing called Pico 8, which is this retro-ish game platform that has been out for a while. And the reason I'm mentioning all this is not really retro at all. This is a very new piece of thing. But the whole thing with this Pico 8 is designed around building kind of retro-styled 2D games in sort of a simplistic way. You know, the kind of games you could have played on a Game Boy Color 20, 25 years ago. And so they're now shipping this thing, the Pocket Chip, which again is this cool-looking little handheld device with a keyboard and with the Pico 8 environment on it. So you can actually build games right on this little thing. Seems pretty cool. $49. I've not played with this, but I am itching to do so because it looks pretty sweet.
Yeah, this looks amazing. Yeah, I also want to pick up one of these.
Yep.
Do they ship to Canada?
Yeah, I was going to say.
Where do they ship? Yeah, so you can it says you can pre-order now for $49. A friend of mine, I got to know about this because a friend of mine posted on Twitter. He said, "Hey, I got my Pocket Chip today," and like I didn't even know this was a thing. So it is.
It's weirdly unfinished looking for like the finished product. Looks like it needs another case around. I'm cool with it, but it's because it's also like a hobbyist computer. It's like, why don't we just expose this board on the top where you could like solder something in? And I dig it though. Yeah, this looks really fun.
Super handy fun computer, it says.
Yeah, and for $50. Nice. Yeah.
The harsh limitations of Pico 8 are carefully chosen to be fun to work with.
It's still difficult for me to get my head around the idea that this is a $49 computer. It's a 1 gigahertz chip, 512 megs of RAM. I'm old enough that that stuff still shocks me.
Right.
Where I'm like, what? Come on.
What are you talking about? That makes no sense.
Yeah, that's cool. I might well, you know, and in fact, I think when we talked about this before, I was on the verge. I was pretty tempted even then. But now that it's actually shipping and in people's hands.
Right. Yeah. See, we were talking before just about the chip, which was just the simple computer. And now they've actually kind of, you know, they have an application for this computer is little handheld thing with a screen with Pico 8 built in. So pretty cool.
Yeah. I dig it.
Something
I
on planes.
Yep.
All right. So Blake Patterson on BiteSeller. You know, he periodically posts very interesting articles. You should all go read his blog all the time. But the one I'm mentioning now is an article about him having found a 33-year-old roll of film that had a picture of his first computer setup on it. So he had a TI-99/4A setup. It was a pretty elaborate setup, actually. But he found an old, like, 35mm roll of film. No, that was actually something else. That's where he found a photo of his second Macintosh. I think this one was actually on a disc. Yeah, a disc. Kodak 4000 camera.
That's right. Yeah, great. Really interesting though that he got these developed or whatever you'd call it, not developed.
Yeah, well, I think it was. In fact, the reason that it being on a disc is somewhat important is because almost nobody can develop those anymore. So he had sent this off. In the story, he talks about how he sent it off basically to a company that does this, but they only do it when they get enough people who want them developed to do it. You know, so he sent it off, and it like took 2 years before they had it hit the critical point where they would just develop everybody's discs. So, but it's a pretty nice picture, pretty good setup. It's got a, you know, 99/4A and a big, you know, peripheral expansion box and that's cool in and of itself, just to like have the actual documentary evidence of this. I know I have wanted, I wished I had pictures like that of my setup, but you know, of course, pictures are hard to come by in the past. You know, they get lost and you don't take many because they're expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't quite understand exactly how this came to be black and white. Maybe that was just a side effect of the way this was developed or something. But so I guess Blake had some other photo of his setup that was captured in a photo that he took. So he doesn't have the original photo. We had a photo of the photo. So it's this blurry colored mess. But Chris Osborne, Fostex, was able to sort of like merge the two. He took the black and white photo and the kind of the color map of the photo of a photo and got a pretty nice looking image out of it. So that's pretty cool. And it's neat, you know, it's neat to see a 99/4A as it originally worked. It's a fun article anyway. So read that and then all the rest of his articles.
Yeah, totally. It's such a great site. It's so weird how I did read this at the time when he had tweeted about it, and I thought it was fascinating. I love the colorized photo. And yet, even though he so clearly explains what disc film is, I still misunderstood until you corrected me just now. I'm like, no, what the? Oh, it's actual. Just the word disc, I just latched onto the idea that this was like a Quick Take 100 or whatever. Like it was a disc that had areas that stored it, but it wasn't really film. It was just an obscure file format. No, this actual film, which is like, I read this paragraph, I'm like, how did I misunderstand that? Like, it's very clearly film. But I still, I read the word disc, and then my brain just said, eh, the rest will be words you can ignore.
Well, usually when I'm speaking, that is true.
No, even when I read it the first time from Blake, when I read it, like, I think a week ago or something, or a little less than that, that it got published. And at the time, I still was sure that this took some sort of, like, weird disc that was a disc, that not film. I don't know.
Yeah.
I still say rewind, so I'm old.
I mean, even just apart from the technological aspect of how this got put back together and what's the subject of the picture of it's still a neat story. I would, you know, like, I would love to have that happen to me. So
a friend of mine actually said that he has some pictures of our old computer store where we used to work.
Oh, cool. Mm.
Yeah, and I was trying to get him to dig those up. He says, oh, you know, they're like in the basement or something like that. And I was like, come on, man. That would really be cool if you could dig those up. We'll see. I'll poke him again.
I do notice the case that about every 10 years, I think, I wish I had photos of something from 10 years ago. And that's happened all through my life. And yet still, I don't take a lot of photos. I'm a difficult man to teach. And learning don't stick with me always. But like, it always feels like, well, it's too late to start taking photos of my computers and things and my setups, because who cares now? But I would love to have my photos from even just 10 years ago, 2006 or something. Sure, yeah, that would be really interesting to look at. But in 2006, I was thinking, oh, if I had started in the 90s, it might have been interesting. But now it's too late and boring. Look at all these fancy colored Macintosh computers and things. Who cares about that? And I'm thinking the same thing now. And 10 years from now, when things are just, you know, a helmet on our head or whatever, they go, oh, remember back when computers were physical objects and they didn't rule us with an iron fist, but had photos. They don't let us take photos anymore, the computer overlords. And I'll be thinking then, I talked in the podcast about how I could take photos, and yet I still won't take photos. Well. Learn from my mistake, folks. Don't be a Carrington.
Yeah, actually, somewhat related to that is your next thing, too, this video you found of the prehistory of Bungie.
I have another thing? Oh, I do have another thing. Yeah, okay, yeah. Yes. This is, so it's a really neat little video, definitely worth watching. I was sure in listening to it that I thought it was Neil Stephenson was the voice. So the voice seemed really familiar to me. It was some sort of writer, or Neil Gaiman maybe. Yeah, it was Neil Gaiman. It sounds like Neil Gaiman. It's not Neil Gaiman. So don't get excited. It's Neil Gaiman video. But for those of us, I include myself among this, who were early Mac gamers, Bungie was our jam, of course, because of Marathon, and which was like the greatest thing ever and super, super fun. And Bungie was this amazing Mac developer that then, you know, was coming out with Halo, and Steve Jobs got up on stage and said, look at this amazing game that's going to be coming for the Mac, it's Halo. And Microsoft said, how about we back up a truckload of money and you just make that an Xbox launch title, and thank you very much, yoink. And so now, of course, Bungie is not a Mac developer anymore, but it had that first history of being a big Mac developer with a big Mac community following, and then it walked away from that to become a much bigger developer with a much bigger community following. So this is a video in a series of things called Retro Histories. I had not heard of them before, so I thought, let's introduce everybody to the series of videos with this one, which is quite good, and it's a little quick investigation of the early, they call it the prehistory, but it's like the first phase of Bungie. So Bungie from its origin up to the days of Halo. And a lot of people might not realize that there was a whole Bungie before Halo. And so if you are new to that, then you might find this interesting. If you're an old Mac gamer, you will find it wistful and definitely worth watching, because anything to do with Marathon is always worth looking at. So good video, not very long, definitely worth a gander.
And yeah, not just Marathon, but Pathways into Darkness too.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, and every once in a while I am reminded that Bungie still exists, you know, because he comes across some ad on TV or something like that, you know, but I completely lost track of them after Marathon.
And Myth as well, which are, I have rarely in my life ever played real-time strategy games. Not my sort of game at all. But I was such a big Bungie fan that I played Myth when they brought it out. And I thought, okay, I think Oni was theirs as well. So good Mac games. And Myth, and then Myth 2, I think The Fallen Lords, I think it was called, something like that, were amazing games and really interesting and real-time strategy games that I actually played all the way through. And I think the only times I've ever done that, anything to do with that genre, were those games. Because I was just such a big fan of Bungie, and you felt like you were in safe hands as a Mac gamer. Like, they would put out only good stuff, which they did. Marathon, of course, there's the Alif One project. So mm-hmm. if you want to play the Marathon games on a modern computer, then you could do it that way because it's all been, I believe, open sourced. But in any case, there is a legal way to play all those, and they are awesome, and they hold up, and I love the Marathon games very, very, very much.
Sometime in the past month or something, I came across a news group posting I had posted in college, I guess. Actually, it must have been just after college because they were supposed to demo Marathon at Macworld Boston. And, you know, so there was like these frantic messages like, did anyone go? What did they see? You know, like apparently it had been postponed a couple months, actually. So there was a little demo, but they didn't actually have it for sale. But it was, you know, it was kind of interesting to see that little window of the enthusiasm as you know, everybody was waiting for Marathon. It was quite a big deal at the time.
That reminds me of a story I don't think I've ever told on any podcast. So here's a little interesting thing from the history of Carrington, where I discussed and tried to convince, I discussed with a person from Bungie at Macworld Boston. One of them, I think it wasn't the year Marathon came out. In fact, it was maybe for Marathon 2. It was deep into the Marathon cycle, and a Bungie rep was at like a big booth, and I talked to him about something I wish they would change in the Marathon games. And I said, I have a problem with your key mapping. And he said, oh, interesting. Like, tell me. Like, he was really open to the idea. And then as soon as I told him what I liked, I could just see him shut down, and his face was like, yeah, no, you're an idiot. So I distinctly remember this guy looking at me like, oh, yeah, okay. And I was like partly just still in the middle of saying it. And I could just, I've just lost him. He was just dead against the idea. So as an early Mac user and Mac gamer, unlike a lot of early computer users, I was a very good touch typist. I had learned to touch type. I can still do it. So I had my fingers on the home row, and I was very used to that. Like, that's where my hands naturally fall. And as gaming became a big deal, there's the whole, ASDW setup, and which is the idea that you're going to take your left hand away from where it normally sits and slide it to the left. And I always on early games back then would say, no, let me set it up. And so for me, it was SDFE are my movement keys, because that's where my hand naturally sits. And I can reach all the keys from there, because that's where a hand should go. And it drove me crazy that all games decided that, no, you don't put your hand where you normally would. Why don't we just, for some stupid reason, shift everything one key to the left? Made no sense. So I just explained to him, like, why can't it, at least games should have that as an option. Like, why do I have to reprogram every stinking key? Why can't there be a, I know how to type option, and I could just pick and it would fill that in. He was not open to the idea, and that never became part of Bungie shipping. So there you go.
Cool.
The industry didn't appear to embrace it either.
Nobody did.
WASD is still WASD.
Yep. And I now just play that way. I eventually got won over. I still fight some early things. I used to fight about against the hyphen in the word email and the pluralization of emails. Like, I lost those fight and just say whatever you kids want me to say now. I don't care anymore. You know, you've worn this old guy down.
Did you capitalize so, internet?
Yes, I did for the longest time, because there's an internet and there's the internet. Duh, see, I still get upset about that stuff.
Internet is capitalized. Do people not do that?
No, they don't.
Oh, you have to.
You would
proper
think
name.
You have to.
Capitalize it.
I got a bunch of emails about
answer
that.
Answer to me.
Still sounds wrong to me. Emails? Really? Emails? Mails? I got a bunch of mails today. You
love
kids.
My Legos.
My spaghettis. Like, just some things. I just, I get language change. You Americans say foyer. I'll never be won over to that either. You know, things change and whatever. I'm old. I'll just be over here with my hands in the proper place on a keyboard playing my old Mac games.
I think it would actually be really quite interesting I'd like to hear from, like, Panic about their early days, or Ambrosia, or like, you know, the people.
Oh, Ambrosia. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. So
I would like to have a Marathon LAN game at Kansas Fest one year. I might arrange that for not this year, but next year. Ship down a bunch of 7600s or something and say, okay, who's with me?
Yeah.
That'd be super
Marathon
fun.
Marathon.
A Marathon Marathon. Yeah.
I think John from RetroMacCast will be at Kansas Fest and has set up marathons at BCF Southeast before, LAN party things. So he will know how to do it. He may not bring all of his equipment for it. But
Maybe I'll talk to him about that, about helping get that arranged for the following year, because I have done that a bunch of times, and including in the last few years. Like, my friends and I will get together and we will have a LAN party. And so I have gone through the struggle of setting up, and I have disk images for, like, this is what you should put on the hard drive and it'll all just work. So
cool.
Yeah, that could be fun.
All right. Well, I think we have made it through the items of interest and news for now. So now a word from our sponsor.
Connect to the Quantum Link network, and suddenly, a diverse new interactive world of easy-to-use services is right at your fingertips. Beginning with People Connection, the social center of Quantum Link, where people from across the nation converse, exchange information, share ideas, and participate in informative lectures. People Connection also features an exciting lineup of multiplayer games. And only on Quantum Link, Lucasfilm's Habitat. A revolutionary entertainment experience where players control their own characters, interacting with other players to explore an imaginary evolving world full of fantasy and the unexpected. The promise of telecommunications has finally come home with Quantum Link. Fun, affordable, easy to use. And it's bringing computers to life with a network so diverse that the way the world communicates may never be the same again. Quantum Link.
And we're back. All right, so it is now time for the host's gift idea. And just sort of on the theme of the Apollo guidance computer, I thought I would propose Disky. It is the Display Keyboard Apollo Guidance Computer Model Art Craft Kit. So I didn't quite realize what this was initially when I found it. I looked at it and thought, that is amazing. It's a little display keyboard thing, that is sort of iconic for the Apollo Guidance Computer. It turns out, so I can't quite tell how big it is. It turns out it's made of sort of like hard paper. It's kind of like cardboard or something, but it doesn't look like it. It looks really good. It is, I think, $45 prior to shipping, at least, and it's made of a bunch of different pieces that you assemble together. It's got, at least it looks like, pictures of all that crazy wiring in there. It's really cool, actually.
And I thought it actually lit up because it different lights are turned on in different photos, but it actually just has different insets you can put in and say, make it look like this part is lit up. It still looks really awesome, though.
Yeah, it looks great. I would like something like this that did light up. That was I had searched around for a little while to find such a thing, and did not find such a thing. But it seems like maybe you could take this and a chip or whatever it is, you know, like a Raspberry Pi Zero or something, and, you know, actually try to get it to light up.
But this is a really neat looking static model. Mm-hmm. I like this. Good find.
Yeah, it'd be fun to have this on your desk. I think Fran, what's her name? Fran of Frantone has done. Maybe she's. I know she's worked a fair bit on the Apollo guidance computer stuff, and I think she might have also built a replica of this same thing, except, you know, not out of cardboard. I'll have to find that. If I find the link to that, I will. I believe I saw a piece of a YouTube video where she was working on that.
If you could make a really working one of these, you could stick it in your car and then basically imagine you're like Flight of the Navigator or something like that. Right. Go to the moon.
Anyway, yes, so I will seriously consider this, and everyone listening should also seriously consider this. It looks very nice. And now, the eBay auctions. Carrington, you, being first alphabetically, will start us off.
Well, cool. Then I'm picking something that only has a little bit of time left, 2.5 days or something. And it's got a buy it now price of $225, which is a bit high, but for the $125 current bid, and there are no bids, it's a bargain. It is a Performa 475, one of my favorite of the classic Macs. Really, really nice computer and easy to max out. You can put a real 040 in it. It's a screaming little computer for what it is. The best of the little pizza box Macs, I think. And this one ships, it's one of the computers that can take an Apple IIe card. This one has the Apple IIe card in it and working. So it's the computer, the monitor, an external, at least from the photos, and I'm assuming that it's included in this because it doesn't say that it's not, but it's got the CD, either 300 or 600, the external CD-ROM drive, the monitor, keyboard, bunch of box software. It's a screaming deal for what it is. If you can pick this up for $125, it is a crazy bargain. Huh. Probably even for $225, frankly, like just the components. I'm like, oh my goodness. So it's just really nice. It's got the 36 megs of RAM, which is I think the max for that size. Anyway, it's a very loaded, good deal. It's flown under the radar so far. 2.5 days. Paul will probably buy it right after we talk about it. So it's gone. But for $125 or whatever, like that's crazy low. So if you can snag it for that, you've got yourself a bargain. For a second choice, another vintage Mac thing, something that doesn't come up very much. I love the Apple Vision monitors. Those are the old monitors that had the built-in speakers on the lower half. One of the nice things about it is ergonomically, it's a nice monitor size. Old monitors then used to be like little, this is the 750, so I think it's actually the 1750, even though it's listed as a 750. I think they were actually the 1750. But whatever, it's the 17-inch monitor versus the 14-inch monitor. And even back then, the monitors were quite low ergonomically. You're looking down at them if they sat on your desk. So the nice thing about the built-in speakers is it lifts the display up to a nicer size, and you have nice-sounding built-in Apple speakers. If you have something like this sitting on top of like a 6100 or something, it really goes well with those. And it's $70, or buy it now for $91. And it's working. Looks like the screen's all nice. It's quite yellowed, but that's retro brighty away. Nice monitors, and they don't come up that often. So they are heavy, though. It says the shipping weight is 60 pounds, so it is local pickup only, alas. So if you are near Cranston, Rhode Island, run, don't walk, and pick yourself up a really nice monitor for $70.
And you will not be running back.
No, run and then waddle back, because these things weigh a ton, but they're a nice, nice, nice monitor. And I have like a standing eBay search for the Apple Vision monitors, but so they rarely come up. I prefer the smaller of the two. I prefer the 14-inch size, but they're nice monitors. So I just thought, in case anybody else always has is always on the lookout for one, there is one currently on eBay.
Cool.
Yeah.
Back on the Performa 475. That is amazing. That is really.
I'm looking over to see, is it still there? Oh, yeah. Has Paul pulled the trigger?
I think I have nearly everything here already.
I have one of these.
But.
And it's so nice. Like if I didn't have one of these, this wouldn't be my pick. I would be buying one. Mm-hmm. But I have this exact computer. I love it. The Quadra 605 is essentially the same computer. And there's the 476 as well, which is a little more rare. All the exact same computer. But this is nice because it comes with the Apple IIe card. It shows that it's working. It comes with the 5.25-inch drive, and there's a particular 5.25-inch drive you have to use with the 2E card. You can't use any of them, and it's got the right one. So like this is just, if you're looking for an all-in-one, you know, OS 6 or OS 7 computer plus an Apple II, this is great, and for $125, it's a screaming deal. So, mm-hmm. Plus, it's got like a boxed copy of Myst and Doom. The Doom and the AD&D collector's box. Like it's just like the components here could be resold for more than $125, and you can just keep the parts you want. Mm-hmm. So it's a really good deal.
Manuals are wrapped still too.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's nice enough that I already own it and I still want to buy it because I like it so much, but I literally have no reason, so I am not going to be purchasing it. But somebody should, because it's a really nice computer.
I also will not, but sometimes I am tempted when I see something that's really cheap and I already have it, just to get it, just to like bring down the average of what I've spent on it.
Exactly. I know for my that is basically the old Mac that I've hung on to is my 475, and all the components in that, I have definitely spent more than $125 on disassembling that thing.
Yeah. All right. Well, keeping with the Apple theme, Earl, you have picked an Apple thing.
I have. I wanted to say let me start out by saying a couple things that no one on earth will care about. And you may wonder, well, how's that different than anything else you say? I just to cut off those kind of snarky comments. But if you want me to not look at your eBay auction, then the best way to get me to ignore it is to put *, rare, *, on it, or to stick your cap locks key and just type everything in all caps.
It's missing the word Steve Jobs, but other than that, this title does check all the boxes for awfulness two exclamation points at the end and two periods too. Awesome.
Exactly. So it's just, you know, some kind of weird fate that I decided to look at this, but it's such a cool item that I'm glad I did. This is an Apple graphics tablet for the Apple II. I have never seen one of these. Have you guys?
Mm. Yep.
Yeah, I have one. But only one.
You do. You do. Cool. And have you ever actually plugged it in? Does it work?
I haven't. It took me actually kind of a while to assemble all the. You can see in this auction there's a couple of different pieces. There's a stylus and a card and the tablet itself. And actually the colored thing on top of it is overlay. So sometimes this is nice because the overlay is there. Sometimes they will have fallen off. But so it took me a while to assemble the pieces, and I only fairly recently got the stylus. So I haven't plugged it in, but I hope to. In fact, I hope to try it on the Apple III. But
very cool. So in this case, all the pieces are there, and it looks like it's in nice shape. And I've always loved graphic tablets. I thought it's an innovative way to input information into the computer. I'd love to see it running with late 70s, early 80s technology. I think it would be fascinating to see how the resolution of the tablet would translate into the graphics on the screen and which programs, for instance, on the Apple II you'd use. But I'm looking at this and I just love it. So it's $150. It's got one bid, 9 days left to go. So the auction still might be open by the time the show airs. Mm-hmm. And so that's my pick. I love the little tablets. I've actually got a little Wacom, one of the USB tablets that I take every now and again and just play around with, because I think Pen is, I'm still a little befuddled why Pen never took off as any more of an input method than what it did. But these old, you know, late 70s, early 80s tablets with their stylus, it was an attempt to get some other sort of input method going. I imagine artists use them and that kind of thing. But anyway, that's my pick. Really looks nice.
Yeah, I do really like the look of these. They're big, too.
Well, you can see in comparison to the card that's up on the top in this picture, you can see the size of the tablet is substantial.
Mm-hmm. I have a theory of why Pen. I thought about that before. Like, why did Pen stuff never take off? And honestly, I think it's because of the hassle of picking up and putting down the pen. Like, if you have a pen beside you, the nice thing about a mouse is you just lift your hand off and it just stays there ready to go. With a pen, you have to put it down or stick it in like a fake inkwell, or they roll all over the place, and it's got the cable coming up from the top of it on early ones. And so it's just, that's enough of a hassle that it ruins it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Maybe if you could attach it to your finger, you know, somehow, because I the alternative of drawing with your finger, I actually really hate, because, you know, it's a big fat spot, you know, it's not a nice sharp tip, but maybe if you had like some sort of like finger extender that was sharp.
But then you can't type.
And then people would be poking each other with them. It'd be mayhem.
Mayhem.
Oh, another thing that I think I remember about the graphics tablet is that if you were to get one of these, one place that you don't want to then put all of your floppies is on it, because I think they will be erased.
Oh, I did not know that.
A little somewhat frightening aspect of this. It might not be true, but I think I remember that being true of the graphics tablet. Let's see. Okay, so I guess I have the next one. I have a couple, actually. But so the first one, this seems pretty cool. It's
awesome.
It's a vintage radio controlled flight simulator with transmitter program Dave Brown. It's basically a radio controlled airplane simulator that runs on the PC, and it has a special joystick that is used for this. So there's a program which is like a flight simulator, except you're driving a remote controlled plane, which is distinguishable in some way from an actual simulated plane. But the thing that's actually kind of coolest about this is that it comes with a controller. So it's like a dual joystick controller that I guess matches relatively well the kind of controller that you would use on a remote control plane. I've never driven a remote control plane, but I have the Apple II version of this. It has the same controller, but with a thing that plugs in, and I haven't tried it out yet, but it's, you know, I'm not competing for this one, because this one's for the PC.
I love the controller, though. Like, the little handheld dual thumb joystick controller is amazing. Mm-hmm. I think that's an awesome looking little joystick.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, no bids yet. It starts at $20. So it's, you know, it's quite reasonable for what it is. I don't know how, I'm not sure how high up it will get bid, but it's been listed for a couple of days. So anyway, yeah. So if you are interested in flight simulation or interesting controllers, this is a good place to look. And may not have that much competition just because it's for the PC, and I'm not sure that there are all that many people in that, you know, at that intersection of all those sets. Next one I have is just, there's another UNIVAC ashtray. I just love these things. I have one just like this from, I think, the same seller. I think they must have a pile of them. But it's so out of place, you know, that its time is so far gone.
Yep. You don't smoke around your vintage computer?
It's really nice, though. It's clean. I think you can see in the photo there, it's got a felt bottom.
It's minty fresh.
Quite nice. And the last one. Okay, so yeah. So I wasn't sure if this was going to still be there. This is of not, you know, it's interesting, like, in a sense that monitor was interesting before, and that it's local pickup only. It is a big pile of, like, Lisa stuff with some old Macs, and the description says basically, you know, here's a couple of two Lisas and some keyboards and the software and a couple of Mac 512Ks, and you know, nobody gets this, it's going in the dump. so you know, at least there's something to that thread, I suppose, in that the auction started at $50, so it wasn't, you know, it's not like holding people for ransom. It's, I want to get rid of this. And so someone did bid $50, so now it's just starting there. It is local pickup only in the, I think, Sacramento area. So if you are near there, you can pick it up. It's basically like two Lisas. Probably neither one actually works. Only one of them is complete. One of them is missing. It looks like the CPU has been taken out of the board and stuff, but it's got, there are enough pieces there that I can imagine you could get two Lisas together and a couple of old Macs, which may or may not work. The thing that actually I think is maybe even more interesting, well, as interesting as the Lisas, is the software is there too, like the manuals and things for the original thing. So if you are interested in this and are in the Sacramento area, take a look at this, because it's right now it is, you know, it's at $50, it is worth way more than that if you were to, like, turn around and sell these pieces, for example, except for the ones you want to keep. It'll be worth way more than that. So anyway, if you're interested in this, it's kind of interesting just to see that such an auction can be listed still even in 2016. That's about it. I don't think I had more on that. So Jack, you are next.
I've got something very weird that I stumbled across. This is the Jet TV Electromagnetica computer. In case you're not familiar with what that is, it's a Romanian Spectrum ZX clone from the late 80s that is built in what is clearly the casing of a desktop telephone. You can see the spot where the telephone receiver would be placed down. It's very, very weird. And the keycaps are... Like, the keys are transparent plastic on the top, and then, like, to actually identify what the things are, the little pieces of paper that I'm not even sure if these are printed. These may be hand-drawn, for all I can tell.
This is amazingly cool.
But I like how they're all a little crooked as well, and the L is, like, too high.
Yeah, like, none of them...
Nothing lines up.
Nothing lines up at all. This is the craziest-looking thing, and, like, it's so weird that this is something that was actually manufactured, but I guess... Manufacturing in communist Romania was not what we think of manufacturing in the Western world. So,
actually, looking at a close-up of these keycaps, I think there's a chance they were made on a plotter.
Could be.
And then cut out. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at the way that some of the letters are formed, they remind me of old plotted color output.
Yeah, could be. So this thing is pretty crazy. The price seems pretty high for what is just kind of a weird off ZX clone, but because right now it's listed at 200 British pounds, or 199 rather, mm-hmm. which is a lot of money.
Yeah, but presumably you don't see these often.
Presumably not. Yeah. So if you're, you know, if you are a ZX fan and like to get your complete set of clones on, here you go.
Plus, if you're going to go to JetFest this year,
that's right.
The 5-day gathering for Electromagnetica enthusiasts, then it's not complete if you don't bring your own. So.
That's right.
These Eastern European computers, you know, both the clones and some of the original models, they're just so fascinating to look at.
Yep.
I wouldn't mind adding one of these, not this one in particular, but at some point I wouldn't mind having one of these in my collection.
Sure.
Commie.
There seem to be a lot of them. I mean, they're all Spectrum clones, but there are many, many different varieties of these, just sort of like miscellaneous clones. I think it could take a long time to collect them all.
Right.
But I've been tempted by a lot of these.
Actually, there was one that we talked about. It was a few months ago. One of the Eastern European, it was a personal computer, but it was based off of a PDP-11
mm-hmm.
CPU.
Yeah, Electronica, right. I think.
Yeah.
I have, you know, kept my eye out for those, and none have seemed sort of achievably cheap. But that would be pretty cool to get one of those.
I'd love to meet a lady named Electromagnetica. I think I would fall in love with her immediately. That's like the best name ever. Or a band. Yeah. That'd be a great name for a band. We are Electromagnetica. I would totally buy everything they put out.
Golf clap from the corner.
The first album would be called Jet TV.
You know what? You guys were a band. Do this. Yeah. Make this happen.
That's it. Got it.
All your music will be composed on knockoffs of the ZX. Amazing.
Pixar, it didn't happen.
All right. Perhaps the... Need to get the show back on the rails here. But although, in fact, we are reaching the end of our run today. So we'll go around the table quickly to see if anyone has any things to add. Carrington, you are, again, alphabetically first, still, perhaps.
And I got stuff. I do got stuff. So we talked about the mega processor. I love the mega processor. Last episode, and you know, just because now there's the video and stuff. But it was interesting how after our show, the mega processor seemed to really hit the mainstream. So I got a link to throw in from the BBC. But it suddenly bubbled up into mainstream news around the world because I guess they found the hook. And I just want to bring this up because it's interesting how the week and weeks before. Those of us in the retro community were all talking about how it was amazing. And it's like walking inside a computer and look how big it is. And it's just like how the tech itself for its own sake was worth talking about and interesting. But the mainstream news ignored it. And then somebody had the idea that, oh, the whole point is a person has built a giant computer on which he plays Tetris. Suddenly it's picked up everywhere. And it's funny how it really made me realize, like when we talk about retro computing stuff, the fact of its existence is kind of enough for us. But the BBC doesn't care about the fact that this thing existed. But when it was now interesting to the public, it seems they thought, is when it was, oh, giant silly computer that a person plays Tetris on. It was a way to make the general public understand what you're talking about. They need to talk about what is its purpose. Just existing wasn't enough. And so I found that interesting that it really made the news in a bunch of places. And everybody was talking about how the guy built a giant Tetris machine. I'm like, that's your angle? The Tetris? There's so many more interesting things. But so we'll have a link to the BBC talking about how it's a giant Tetris machine.
I put a little link in the show notes to Tetris on the Green Building. It's another place that Tetris has been played. MIT has a very tall building with office lights that lend themselves perfectly to being lit up in a Tetris game. So at some point, it was, you know, some night, Tetris was played on the side of this building by lighting up offices.
But imagine if you're in there trying to work, and your light's like green, now it's black, and it's like, I wish you would get a stinking T-shape because I can't see my keyboard.
Right.
Like, now I'm green, now I'm red, now the whole floor has been fired because you got a whole building filled in. It's neat to watch, though.
Yeah.
I love giant games on the sides of things.
Yes.
And another really quick thing on Twitter, this actually happened, I think, a couple weeks ago, but I forgot to mention it. Brianna Wu, who's really fun to follow and everybody should, she posted a photo of a modem and said, okay, I just want responses from people born after 1990. What do you think this is? And it's a really fun thread to read because, of course, it is the case that everything on the internet, when you say, I only want responses from a certain people, white males in their 30s and 40s, my demographic, all want to answer anyway. So ignore them because everything is not about us. Like, come on, guys. But the millennials who answer are all like, is it a telephone? I think it's a toaster of some sort. They're looking at what is very clearly a modem. And a few of them would say, oh, yeah, my dad showed me these. That's got something to do with like being a modem and stuff. So a few nail it. But a lot of people, like a few people think that it's a radar detector. They look at it and go, they have no idea. And so it's how interesting that like a generation younger than, you know, us and most of our listeners, they can look at a thing that we all grew up with and you would just immediately go, yeah, it's a modem. It looks like a 2400 baud one. I can tell you what all the lights mean. They're like, is it a radar detector? Is it a heater? What is that? So it's just how neat how the modem is no longer a thing people can recognize by sight.
Yeah.
But men in their 30s also wanted to chime in exactly about what it was. And way to go, us guys. You made me proud. You make the internet such a wonderful place with your opinions.
Little lights are, that's a high school, and there's a compact disc, some kind of support group. Ohio.
So anyway, it was a fun thread. So, and it's neat when that kind of thing comes up. So I thought I'd say, look at that. Picture of a modem. Kids don't know what it is. Kids today.
Yeah, there's some kind of a recurring, you know, sort of like a joke about kids seeing a floppy disk or something and saying, oh, you 3D printed the save icon.
I wonder when that's going away, the idea of saving, but the save icon itself.
That's true, you don't
it's
save.
It's so silly. It's so silly. Why would you save? Just everything should save all the time, constantly.
So, Earl, any thoughts?
Oh, no.
Okay.
First of all, it's pronounced URL. We're getting his name wrong.
Right, of course.
Thank you, finally.
And Jack, anything going on in Sweden?
Not much. I've been doing my share of looking at some thrift stores and flea markets and stuff, always keeping an eye out for interesting old computer stuff, and as usual, finding nothing.
Sorry.
Yeah. What can you do?
Thanks for staying up late so that Carrington and Paul could watch their football stuff.
Wait, is that why we rescheduled?
Yep.
Wow. Okay.
But we only bring this up at the end.
And I mean international football, not U.S. football.
All right.
Soccer. That's what we properly call it.
Yep. All right, cool.
And so Michael had something to report but didn't show up because he's traveling. But he posted some interesting stuff, some photos of the Living Computer Museum, I think he was at. So if you quickly go to our Twitter feed, you can see, or maybe this is even on our Facebook group, you can see his photos from that. And hopefully next time we'll hear him, or maybe time after next, we'll hear him talk about his trip to the Living Computer Museum. And I think Ken is actually about to go there as well. So we'll have many reports from there. But
because next time we will be at Kansas Fest.
We will indeed. Yes. Far too soon for me in terms of being ready for the talk. I guess I'm giving a presentation on the Thursday. The schedule
I'm doing
is just
nothing this
out.
Year. Oh, I'm so lazy lately.
Well, you're distributing your door across the campus, as I heard, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm still trying to. I have yet to work on that. I really got to. So my door is going to be a distributed door. So I must work on that this week.
Okay. So next time you hear from this feed, I think, I'm not sure exactly. There's a couple things that might be coming up on this feed next having to do with Kansas Fest. And so.
Yeah, we generally do like a big, everybody from a bunch of other podcasts will slum and come onto our show. That'll probably happen, I think.
Yeah,
so
I think
we'll see.
I think that's likely to happen. And there may also be a sort of like a trivia game that who's hosting?
I think Kevin.
I think you're right. Kevin Savitz.
Oh,
we've
mentioned him again right at the end of the show.
But so that may wind up on this feed as well. So, and then everybody should want for the next year, sign up immediately to go to the next Kansas Fest if you can't quite make it in a week and a half or whenever it is. But
and if you're going this year and it's your first time, I really, really want to hang out with you. Come and say hi, and we will have breakfast and lunch together, and we will meet and be friends, and it will be awesome. So there's usually new people at Kansas Fest, and I love meeting the new people. So it is super fun. I love Kansas Fest. Highlight of the year. Cannot wait. I'm so excited.
Jack, you need to go to one. You're so far the only one here that hasn't.
I know. It's terrible. One of these days, I will make it up there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess that's it for this show. You can find show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast, and you can join our Facebook group by searching for Retro Computing Roundtable. In fact, actually, we have /group/RCR Podcast now, apparently. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, and we are a member of the Throwback Network, which has a Facebook page and is at throwbacknetwork.net as well. Please write a review on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And until next time,
Retro Compute!